isn't going.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 615. It's me and Jason, and we're going to be drawing primarily from a book that we've mentioned a couple times. The book's called Pawns in the Game. We're pretty sure it comes from 1955, and we'll get into it here. Jason drew the notes on this one, so welcome, Jason.
And a chilly good morning.
Anything you want to add before we jump on in?
Well, this is an interesting book from an apparently very interesting guy, literally guy. I'm not sure what to say about him just because there's a lot of what I think is misinformation about him and where he drew his information from. So you just kind of have to take it as it comes. We're covering the book and we'll add in what we can where we can.
Yeah, there are some claims that what we're going to cover got lifted from Albert Pike. And while it corresponds, there's no doubt I don't buy that. In the opening, there's ideas that he was approached to be a part of things. And how do they put it, Jason? He was offered it hook, line, and sinker, but he turned it down. And that sets aside how I became familiar with this text. It was recommended to me by someone who had things to say about it. So from my point of view, it's probably on the up and up. And it goes to show you, so this comes out in 55 or 56. The man who wrote it dies in 59, but nobody's really heard of this text. People forget that before the internet, how a text became popular, a book, was pretty easily controlled with things like the New York Times bestsellers lists and publishers. And as Jason pointed out, this was originally published by a very small Christian organization, apparently.
William James Guy Carr was born on June 2nd, 1895, in Formby, Lancashire, England, and he died on October 2nd, 1959, in Ontario, Canada. He was a Canadian naval officer, serving in the Royal Navy during World War I. During World War II, he was a Navy control officer for the St. Lawrence, staff officer operations at Shelburne, Nova Scotia, and then senior naval officer at Goose Bay, Labrador. He also worked for the Canadian Intelligence Service during World War II. He was an author of many books and has been called a prominent conspiracy theorist and is best known for his controversial writings on global conspiracies. These came from a strong Christian perspective. He covered topics like communism, Freemasonry, and what he described as the worldwide revolutionary movement, which could almost certainly be exchanged with the more well-known term of the New World Order. In 1955, he published the book Pawns in the Game, which is what we will be going through in this episode.
Even the opening paragraph here kind of tells you what I think is likely correct. First of all, the man's working for intelligence, and he's already been in one world war. So that kind of tells you that he was easily in a position to have learned things. The other thing is that he's labeled a global conspiracy theorist, and that's always been the tactic back in the day. And that very label may have been one of the reasons why nobody ever really heard of this text, or how something like this didn't get popular, maybe I should say. But go ahead, Jason.
In 1931, Carr started to give conferences in different Canadian clubs on the topic of international conspiracy. He subdivided this into two main subjects, which he called international communism and international capitalism, and stated that both were being controlled by the Illuminati and what he called the international bankers, which is a term that is still used today. According to Carr, the international bankers are represented mainly by the Rothschild and the Rockefeller families. That is now common knowledge today, although there are many other families that are also involved with the central banks around the world.
And this is where it starts to ring true to me. The two things he picks up on, or well, one of them, it's no mystery to anyone that international capitalism, you know, I've talked about this corporation, right? This is how we got into such dire straits, because of corporations and what they're allowed to do and get away with. But the other part of this is international communism. Now, I have been told from an insider's approach, from people who supposedly had families with skin in the game, how the fall of Russia occurred. Fortune has even talked about it with Count Whittier, and his stories around Count Whittier alone show you that what we're about to cover here, it's all in parallel. There's no space between what gets said here and what I've been told from firsthand.
So here's the thing. When you sent this book over and I started going through it, my first question was, how does this guy know this stuff in the mid-50s? And even earlier, once you start reading it, you realize he was talking about this stuff decades earlier. So he'd already identified, however he did it, that the robber barons and the people that we now know are the big money families were behind a lot of this stuff. So I got very curious as to how he would have known such things. And then, of course, you read that he was in intelligence during World War II. So goodness knows what he came across.
Way back then, it is my point of view that there would have been plenty of good men who had their hearts in the right place, that were career servicemen, and they were truly about their flag, their nationality, and their country. Up to where we've come now, it's almost like anyone in power you kind of assume has been co-opted in one way or another. I think this falls before that, Jason, if I had to put a marker down. But the other thing that we're going to cover as we get in here, how many points? I think it's 20, is it 24 or 25 points that he lays down, which is the actual Illuminati roadmap to taking over everything. And I'm not talking about the ridiculous Illuminati, famous people showing one eye or making the diamond symbol with their hands. That's ridiculousness. Those are pawns in the game that are very well paid. They're tools. We're talking about the real deal thing that supposedly got set up or began in 1773 and then launched in parallel with what we're told this country's history is in 1776. Anyhow, go ahead, Jason.
William Guy Carr had written about a three world wars scenario. Carr said that World War I was orchestrated by the Illuminati to overthrow the powers of the Russian czars and establish atheistic communism in Russia, positing that the war was fomented by stirring up differences between the British and German empires. Next, World War II was supposed to have been engineered to destroy Nazism and to enhance the power of political Zionism, which would then lead to the establishment of the State of Israel. Carr suggested that this was done by exploiting the tensions between fascism and political Zionism. World War III, which obviously had not occurred before Carr's death in 1959 and has not transpired yet, would be instigated by using the differences between political Zionists and the leaders of the Muslim world, with this conflict intended to result in the mutual destruction of these groups, which would pave the way for the Illuminati to establish a one-world government under their control.
So anyone can go check out what Albert Pike wrote. And so many people, it looks to me, that want to defame this and make it look like a ripoff or literally some kind of conspiracy nuthatch. In the World War III account, it all starts in the Middle East, right? But the idea behind the whole thing is that they've already destroyed these groups in this country in World War I, and then it went a little further in World War II. In World War III, they knock out Islam, they knock out the majority of Christians, they somehow put, I hope I'm getting this right, Jason, but they somehow put the remainder of Christians at odds with another sect. And when all is said and done, they've knocked out Christianity, I guess Christians linger on for a while, supposedly, but they've knocked out Islam, Christianity, and even Jewishness is on the chopping block there. But the thing is all the way back in the 50s to be saying that World War I was started as a plot and then work up into World War II. Let me tell you something. That is not where my grandparents' mindset was. They were proud to be Americans. They viewed themselves as the best country in the world. The great white knight who saved the entire world from goose stepping or speaking Japanese. That's how that generation viewed it. And what's being said here all the way back in the 50s is a very, very different view.
There is some claim by different authors that Carr learned about the plans for the three world wars from a letter that was supposedly written by Albert Pike, who was a Confederate general and high-ranking Freemason, to Italian revolutionary Giuseppe Mazzini in 1871. The authenticity of this letter is highly disputed, with Carr himself noting in his book, Satan, Prince of This World, that the British Museum had no record of this letter. Regardless, to give some context of where Carr's thinking process was coming from with his work, the first editions of his books were mainly published by the Federation of Christian Laymen, with Carr being the president of the Federation of Christian Laymen in Toronto, Canada. Carr is to draw inspiration from multiple sources for his books, with the unfortunateness of one of those being the admitted French hoaxer, Leo Taxil, who is said to have intended, with his fictional stories that were at first thought to be serious tales, to mock Freemasonry and the Catholic Church's opposition to it. Regardless, William Guy Carr's work has been referenced by numerous other people who also have delved into various conspiracy theory topics.
Well, there's a little bit of logic you can apply here. So if this had been lifted from a Freemason, why would the Christian layman, the Federation of Christian Laymen, have any interest in this? Back then, I would imagine that they wouldn't be interested in all if that had been the case. But the idea of three world wars is do you know the date, Jason? So Guy Carr says that World War III is coming at a time that's already passed. Do you know what that time is, Jason?
Approximately the late 50s or early 60s.
So in other words, he said World War III is coming and it didn't happen. To me, that makes this all the more plausible when we see what has happened and what is going on right now in the Middle East. I mean, we basically have the supposed leader of the free world, as he's often called, saying, I'm just going to go take this land over here and do what I want with it. And the response from that part of the world is exactly what you think it would be. Those are fighting words. And so we still see the fomenting and agitation in that part of the world. And the point I'm trying to make is if you see instability and warlike things emerging in that part of the world, I think it's all the more fuel to the fire that what's been laid down here was spot on.
According to Carr, the forces of evil realized that in order to win undisputed control of the material assets of the world and establish an atheistic, materialistic, totalitarian dictatorship, it is necessary to destroy all forms of constitutional government and organized religion. In order to do this, the forces of evil decided that they must divide the people of the world against each other on various issues. Dating back into antiquity, the Aryan and Semitic races were driven into enmity against each other to serve the secret ambitions of their atheistic, materialistic leaders. Had the people of the Aryan and Semitic races remained steadfast to their belief in God and faithful to his commandments, the forces of evil could never have accomplished their evil purpose. In exposing the causes of the past, which produce effects we experience today, the terms Aryan and Semitic are used loosely and in the broad sense of the words.
And if truer words at this end of this paragraph ever been spoken, when you lose your moral compass, look what happens. Look what's happened to us. And by the way, this was implemented so quickly that the difference in this country between the 50s and the end of the 60s is almost like night and day. It's almost like an entirely different country. We go from people who dress up to walk out their front door to wearing flip-flops and hair halfway down our back by the end of the 60s. And I'm not making a judgment call. I'm just pointing out to you how quickly, one decade, we lost our moral compass. But think about what's being said here. So if they're claiming, well, if we want to take over everything and get our atheistic, materialistic, totalitarian dictatorship, there's a mouthful, we need to destroy all forms of constitutional government. What's happened to us? Right now, we have a president who basically does warlike activity anytime he feels like it, when the Constitution clearly gives that power to, what is it? I think it's the Congress, right, Jason?
Yes.
And it's just ignored. And by the way, it's been ignored for quite some time. And this is the erosion of the very things that are being pointed out here that must be eroded for the so-called forces of evil to take control.
If Carr had lived another decade and saw what the 1960s became, I think he would have recognized the intentional division that was being done to destroy the United States as well as other Western nations.
Well, people should know, right before we turned on the record button, I asked Jason, do you know how Carr died? Well, he died of heart failure at roughly age 59. And the reason I asked that question is because I began to wonder if he's another one of, you know, how often these days do you hear someone had heart failure or pneumonia or something which is getting extremely suspicious? And while we can't nail it down for sure, I asked the question because look at the things he's saying. And Jason's right. If he was alive today, He'd probably just be going back and highlighting half of his book and saying, I told you so.
Carr says that there is evidence to prove that modern communism was organized in the year 1773 by a group of international money barons who have used it since as their manual of action to further their secret plans to bring about a totalitarian godless state. Lenin made this clear in his book, Left-Wing Communism. On page 53, he said, quote, our theory, meaning communism, is not a dogma, meaning a settled doctrine. It is a manual of action. Many modern leaders have said and done the same things as Lucifer did during the Heavenly Revolution. There is no appreciable difference between red and black atheism. The only difference is in the plans used by the opposing leaders to ultimately win undisputed control of the world's resources and bring into being their ideas for a totalitarian, godless dictatorship. Now, if you don't know what he means by red and black atheism, red is in reference to the communists and black is in reference to the fascists.
Yeah, it's almost like we have more descriptions than we need. When I talk to people in the know, it always comes back to communism. And by the way, it's not always on the left, the way that it's described. It's almost like we're at a point of time where nobody is really quite sure how to label it, but at the base of it, they know it relates to communism. But to get back to 1773, this is the claim founding, well, not the founding, the start of the so-called Bavarian Illuminati. It's claimed that they, whatever the correct word would be, franchised or incorporated or whatever the right word is in 1776 was pretty suspicious when you realize that that's America's big date that we bandy about. When I was young, in my teens, the bicentennial in 1976 came up and the whole country was red, white, and blue doing reenactments on the East Coast, anyhow, of the Redcoats are coming. But this paragraph underscores what Fortune told me, that there is no culture that has been drugged down into hedonism. And we can look to supposed places like Rome, if any of those tales are true, to see how that goes, that has recovered from hedonism. And this is the importance of faith. And believe me, I didn't say religion there on purpose, because religion is almost part of this at this point. They're 501(c)s, they're corporations. And that's a problem. That is at odds with what true faith is actually about. And this too has been carefully implemented. My point being is that a nation that has true faith has moral values, and a culture or a nation with moral values is almost bulletproof to things like this because they simply will not accept what is unacceptable.
In the book, Carr states that history reveals that a Jewish goldsmith, Amschel Moses Bauer, tired of his wandering in Eastern Europe, decided in 1750 to settle down in Frankfurt on the Main in Germany. He opened a shop or counting house in the Judenstrasse district. Over the door of his shop, he placed as his sign of business a red shield. It is of the greatest importance to remember that the Jews in Eastern Europe who belonged to the revolutionary movement based on terrorism had also adopted the red flag as their emblem because it represented blood.
And this will shoot off in directions. We way back did an episode on blood, which was very confusing, by the way, because the information you get depends on what part of the world you're getting it from and what race you're getting it from. But there's the Red Cross, of course. But go ahead, Jason.
Carr continues. Amschel Moses Bauer had a son born in 1743, and he named him Amschel Mayer Bauer. The father died in 1754 when his son was only 11 years of age. The boy had shown great ability and extraordinary intelligence, and his father had taught him everything possible about the rudimentary principles of the money-lending business. It had been the father's intention to have his son trained as a rabbi, but death intervened. A few years after his father's death, Amschel Mayer Bauer was employed by the Oppenheimer Bank as a clerk. He soon proved his natural ability for the banking business and was rewarded with a junior partnership. Later, he returned to Frankfurt, where he secured control and ownership of the business, which had been established by his father in 1750. The red shield was still proudly displayed over the door. Knowing the secret significance of the Red Shield, Amschel Mayor Bauer decided to adopt it as the new family name. Red Shield in German is Rothschild, and thus the House of Rothschild, or Rothschild, came into being.
So, I mean, the first story we get, they're setting up a coin-changing shop of some sort, and they put a secret sign outside. I mean, okay. So maybe that does go back to their culture being treated badly in their eyes. Who knows? But on the occult side of things, I have heard the claim that Rothschild, not only relating to what Jason just said, the Red Shield, is occultly somehow used as Ra's child, going all the way back to Egypt, believe it or not.
Amschel Mayor Bauer lived until 1812. He had five sons. All of them were specially trained to become captains of high finance. Nathan, one of the sons, showed exceptional ability and, at the age of 21, went to England with a definite purpose of securing control of the Bank of England. The purpose was to use this control to work in conjunction with his father and other brothers to set up and consolidate an international banking monopoly in Europe. The combined wealth of the international banking pool could then be used to further the secret ambitions his father had made known to all of his sons. To prove his ability, Nathan Rothschild turned £20,000, with which he had been entrusted, into £60,000 in 3 years.
So let me get the story straight. We could have had a rabbi, but Pops died, so instead we got a world fanatic takeover, and for some reason, he gets further into banking after he proves himself and is made a partner, goes back and gets Dad's Red Shield place, and decides he's taking over all international banking in Europe. That's how the story goes? Doesn't it feel like part of that story is missing, Jason?
Kind of seems that way.
Come on. Okay, go ahead.
In 1773, when Mayor Rothschild was only 30 years of age, he invited 12 other wealthy and influential men to meet him in Frankfurt. His purpose was to convince them that if they agreed to pool their resources, they could then finance and control the world revolutionary movement and use it as their manual of action to win ultimate control of the wealth, natural resources, and manpower of the entire world. Rothschild revealed how the English Revolution had been organized. He pointed out the mistakes and errors that had been made. The revolutionary period had been too long. The elimination of reactionaries had not been accomplished with sufficient speed and ruthlessness. The planned reign of terror, by which the subjugation of the masses was to be accomplished speedily, had not been put into effective operation. Even after all these mistakes had been made, the initial purpose of the revolution had been achieved. The bankers who instigated the revolution had established control of the national economy and consolidated the national debt. By means of intrigue carried out on an international scale, they had increased the national debt steadily by loaning the money to fight the wars and rebellions they had fomented since 1694.
Now, I don't know if what he's claiming here has been proven to be 100% historically accurate, but we certainly know that the international bankers love to fund both sides of wars.
See, but this little paragraph shows the gaping hole that I just complained about in the last paragraph. So he invites 12 dudes. Oh, we're going for the magical 12 dudes and a 13th, you know, the 13 steps everywhere. Anyhow, setting all that aside, and they agree to pool their resources to do what? To control the world revolutionary movement. Well, wait a minute. No one said anything about a world revolutionary. You see, there's already this other infrastructure of some sort in place that they're supposedly tapping into or taking over or something like that. But then it goes on to say the planned reign of terror by this other group isn't happening quick enough. But I refer you to the Marvel movies, which were top of the pops as we came into Covidius Minimus. And we are told by the little Austrian dude there who made the algorithm, which showed everybody how to use AI, and it turned the 21st century into an open book. That dude basically says, yeah, in World War II, we went to take over the world, which incidentally is against what's being said here. World War II was a tool. So you got two choices. Either Hitler was aware that he was being used as a tool and went along with it, or had no idea and got his butt handed to him, however that shakes out. But to get back to the point, the guy in the movie rightly says, in my view, well, we learned in World War II that if you start kicking people with steel-toed boots, they fight back and it doesn't go so well. So there's all this going together, but Jason, call me crazy, there's clearly another organization that they are either tapping into, taking over, or something.
So I thought about this as well. There had to have been other things going on in the background that Carr's not getting into. He does state how the English Revolution, which had taken place many years before what he's presenting with Rothschild here, was instigated. So who's doing that?
Well, if you read this between the lines, you get the impression that Pops, the first guy, you know, the guy who was going to have his son be a rabbi, really? So you're going to set up for a world takeover and banking monopoly, because they're saying two things at once. They're saying that that son was going to be a rabbi, but he died. So we got the world takeover guy, the banking takeover guy. But by the same information, you're being told that the father left them a sum of money to further the banking's concerns. So, I mean, you can already find holes in the tales we're being told.
The following points are what William Guy Carr says that Rothschild presented to his other conspirators, beginning with this. The speaker started to unfold the plot by saying that because the majority of men were inclined to evil rather than to good, the best results in governing them could be obtained by using violence and terrorism and not by academic discussions. The speaker reasoned that in the beginning, human society had been subject to brutal and blind force, which was afterwards changed to law. He argued that law was force only in disguise. He reasoned it was logical to conclude that by the laws of nature, right lies in force.
You can see the warped kind of thinking that goes into this, because you can logically work out that the idea of law, and I'm not saying how we see it in the world, but the idea of law is so everything doesn't have to be force. I mean, this goes all the way back to the myth of King Arthur, right? Might doesn't equal right. So from the get-go, it's a pretty one-sided kind of sick-minded view, but unfortunately, it's hard to call it wrong, because he's saying, and he's getting ready to lay down the 24 or 25 bullets and how they're going to do this. He's saying the majority of men, he's telling this group that's going to supposedly go to take over the world, or banking and then the world, that the majority of men are inclined to evil, and that's why this is going to work. And that's a sad commentary, because if we look around now, it's hard to argue that we aren't among the evilest generation we're aware of, with on-demand porn and all the other things that come with it. The kind of insipid filming of ourselves, narcissism at levels that is heretofore unheard of, a level of ridiculousness right now that we don't have anything to bounce it off in the history we're aware of.
So this is kind of interesting that he would say it this way, because in George H.W. Bush's New World Order speech, he had mentioned that it was going to be about the rule of law and not the law of the jungle or something to that effect.
Right, which is basically nonsense, because what they do is the law of the jungle. Let me point Mr. Bush to one of his backyard party favors, 9/11. Is that law, or is that closer to the law of the jungle? I ask everybody, which is that event closer to the law of the jungle or law? Well, for one thing, it's a lie. It's hidden. It was done in secret, and it was done with force. So they're talking out both sides of their mouth, and they don't deserve what they're so close to achieving right here, which in my view is exactly why they're not going to get it. But that doesn't remove the fact of what we've got to deal with, the fact that we risk losing Lord knows how many people, because a population reduction makes all this oh so more doable. But in the long run, we have reached a level in this world where we are no longer going to accept stuff like this. In other words, we're on a razor's edge. If they implement this kind of iron-fisted control quickly enough, then the idea is it doesn't matter how high-minded anyone is. But by the same token, if they don't, that high-mindedness is still growing, to make the point.
There's also the fact that every single thing that has been pushed by the banksters, things like communism and even fascism that was funded by them, ended in brutality beyond all belief. You want to talk about force, we're talking about tens of millions of deaths racked up by the numerous people that they got behind to push these different movements.
Well, there's another piece of this, which is quite scary, actually, and that's the young generation. The young generation is fed up for good reason. They don't want to work, because who wants to work all day and not even come close to paying your bills? Then the older generation makes fun of them for not wanting to work, because what they remember is, I didn't want to work either, but I did. And look, I worked hard and I got what I got. But guess what? You're not getting anything similar now under these conditions, and you know it. But that younger generation has no knowledge of the world before the internet. They don't have a reference point that shows this insipid filming of yourself is narcissism at a level that is unbelievable. It's been normalized to that degree. And that's what makes what's happening now so worrisome. Because what's going to happen to the younger generations? How will they be able to fend for themselves when the older generation is gone? But then I guess I could ask, the older generation's been here, and what did we do to teach them? So I think there's enough blame to go all the way around the table. But the point is, it almost feels like they're waiting for boomers and X to be in the rearview mirror, and then they're going to try to lock it down.
Well, we know that's what's going on. That's why they've been taking over all of the media and everything and polluting it with all of their modern garbage, because we don't matter. It doesn't matter if we're interested in the things they're pushing. They want it to be the younger generations latching onto those things.
And the open admission for AI that's starting to come to the fore is that it would be used to get the younger generation to believe in almost anything. And it's kind of working. Has anyone been online recently to see just some of the things that people readily believe in? And I'm not here to tell you that things aren't possible. I mean, we've all kind of learned that things you didn't used to think were possible may be possible, but that's a far cry from seeing a video that's 15 seconds long convincing you that this thing or that thing is real. And I would estimate that the goal of AI is kind of working.
He next asserted that political freedom is an idea and not a fact. He stated that in order to usurp political power, all that was necessary was to preach liberalism so that the electorate, for the sake of an idea, would yield some of their power and prerogatives, which the plotters could then gather together into their own hands. Now, that's also interesting, because that's exactly what Dr. John Coleman said. They were going to use liberal ideas, the left side of politics, to infiltrate the Western nations and try and bring them down.
Which we have seen. And there's another kind of monkey wrench in the gearing system here, too, because back in the day, the idea of liberal was very different than the idea of liberal is now. And this is partially because such a bang-up job has been done to divide the people that consider themselves left or right. I mean, at this point, Jason, of all the damaging things that have damaged our country, I think I would put politics like top of the pops, maybe TV at the same level, maybe. But the division and the hatred and the inability to come together as a nation has been damaged almost irreparably by these ideas. And we just saw what happened. So the liberals take office, then the conservatives take office, then the liberals take office. But this last time around, things were done that were so offensive to the other side that when they got power, they started ripping it all down, which was so offensive to the side that just did it. And this eking up the inner hatred for your fellow American, it's just so damaging. And it prevents everyone from realizing that we are all in the same damn boat. And that boat is taking on water so quickly right now that it is astonishing. And we really have to stand back and set all this other manipulating crap aside and recognize that our boat is taking on water. We better start bailing. We better start patching the leak.
Well, to those who are old enough to have been around for it, I've heard it said more than once that the left side of politics that's going on today is nothing what it was like decades ago, which was more about helping the common man, the workers, that kind of thing, whereas the Republicans were more for the business types. And now it's just out of control craziness. The left also, this is the one that really gets me, used to be anti-war and anti-corporation and against all the governmental, anything really, anything that the government was pushing. When you look at the movements in the 60s and all that kind of stuff, it's the exact opposite today. It's the other way around. Somehow that got flipped.
It's been ratcheted up, and it's been ratcheted up with the control of media. And not only that, go back and look at TV, just simple TV shows, all the way back to Seinfeld. I could take any Seinfeld episode and point to you what looks like such an innocuous scene where just a comment is made, where in fact that social engineering is going on for division. But back in the 90s, as an example, when people talked about politics, you would always hear, well, they're left of center or they're right of center. The idea being that moderation, being near the center, was the level-headed, the majority somehow, or something like this. And then as we got into the 90s, that slowly began to shift. We got people like Rush Limbaugh, which was such a popular voice, but then moving away from the idea of middle or center and moving idea away from the idea that even though I don't agree with those people, I still talk to them. As a matter of fact, you can go look up a John Wayne clip. I'm pretty sure it's John Wayne. It might be the Academy Awards where he gets up to speak and he says, well, my guy just lost the election, but we're all Americans here, so I wish the new president the best. You would never in a million years hear that in the climate that has been so carefully fomented using social engineering in this country.
That's a gentlemanly attitude, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah, there's something funny you brought up Seinfeld, and I've thought this since way back when. And I'm sure if anybody's a fan of it, they're not going to like what I'm going to say, but it's kind of funny. Seinfeld is a show about four people who are kind of awful people. And I noticed it way back when. They're not very good people. We're just laughing at it. But most people don't realize it. And I just wonder what the writers, especially Larry David, who is the main writer, was thinking about that. Was that like a little joke to him? Or I'm not really sure because I never really got into the show. I just couldn't relate to it. But when you really look at the storylines and everything, the majority of the things they do, they're kind of awful.
Dude, you are so spot on. And I have heard so few people make the assessment you just made, because at the time, that was by far the most popular show in America. I have spoken on this podcast about the Thursday night when the final two episodes were coming on. And we didn't watch TV back then. We went out and did things, but we went out and San Diego was empty. And we're like, where the hell is everyone? And we later find out it was Seinfeld night. Everyone stayed home to watch it. But it was so insidious. These were the worst people, which was summed up in the finale, where they go to jail for being bad people. I mean, there's even an episode where one of them tries to poison another person that insulted them. And it's all just comedy. In a Seinfeld episode, very few people realize the level at which this was written. There are typically three storylines in every episode. And each of the storylines has its own comedy thread, and they all interact in some way, most of them. But the point that you just made is what's been overlooked. The most popular TV show in America is about four horrible, reprehensible individuals who don't give a toss about anyone else but themselves.
So Rose is saying that that is the joke. It was intentionally that way, and I just didn't know that.
Very few people got it at the time. That was not how it was viewed. Even, and that sets aside that most people missed the point of the finale. After the finale, all the people chimed in as if it was some important cultural moment, which I'm here to say it's not. It's a damn TV show. They all said, oh, so disappointing, so this, so that. They all had their opinions. But what they failed to see was that court case was trying you. That judge, Vandalay, I think his name was, makes a comment near the end that lets America know that you were on trial and you failed because you watched this insipid trash. And very few people got it.
The speaker asserted that the power of gold had usurped the power of liberal rulers even then, i.e. 1773. He reminded his audience that there had been a time when faith had ruled, but stated that once freedom had been substituted for faith, the people did not know how to use it in moderation. He argued that because of this fact, it was logical to assume that they could use the idea of freedom to bring about class wars. He pointed out that it was immaterial to the success of his plan whether the established governments were destroyed by internal or external foes, because the victor had of necessity to seek the aid of capital, which is entirely in our hands.
There's the statement right there. We've owned the capital. And so if you want to find the villain in any war or anywhere else, he just told you who holds the purse strings. But let's set all that aside. This is 1773, and I have two questions. The first question, are we supposed to believe by this story, which is written by the victors, right? That's how we get our history. Are we supposed to believe that just one day this Bauer guy was going to form a dynasty and he was just a bit smarter than everyone else? Or is there something else going on? Is there some dark evil attached to this? And I'm sorry, I can't get away from there has to be. It's almost like there's another intelligence below the surface here. But to pull it back around to the world that we'll admit is here, in 1773, that is exactly 200 years before Richard Nixon is going to pull the global standard currency called the dollar off the gold standard entirely. 200 years from this point, that's a long game getting played.
He argued that the use of any and all means to reach their final goal was justified on the grounds that the ruler who governed by the moral code was not a skilled politician because he left himself vulnerable and in an unstable position on his throne. He said, those who wish to rule must have recourse to cunning and to make-believe because great national qualities like frankness and honesty are vices in politics. He asserted, our right lies in force. The word right is an abstract thought and proves nothing. I find a new right to attack by the right of the strong and to scatter to the winds all existing forces of order and regulation, to reconstruct all existing institutions, and to become the sovereign lord of all those who left to us the rights to their powers by laying them down voluntarily in their liberalism. He then admonished his listeners with these words, the power of our resources must remain invisible until the very moment when it has gained such strength that no cunning or force can undermine it. He warned them that any deviation from the line of the strategical plan that he was making known to them would risk bringing to naught the labors of centuries. So, if that's true, then that states that there were other powers at play long before what they were trying to do at this time.
He admitted it. This is all the way back in 1773. The Illuminati is not even incorporated yet, and he's admitting the labors of centuries. And I'm just going to say it, and I know people are going to roll their eyes. It's because they're in bed with a demon or some such. That's where the genius is coming. That's where the evil is coming. Look, we have a world which, if you logically look at whether good can exist in the world right now, you hit a brick wall. Let's use the example that I've used so many times of Tibet. So whatever Tibet's problems may or may not have been, set it aside. It was a country where everything was built on the idea of faith and compassion. That was the stated, open, supposedly achievable goal. There's only one problem. Look at what happened to it the moment anyone wanted to march over the top of it. And this is the problem with being good in our world, which he just stated by saying liberal. So these suckers choose to be liberal, and then we come in and mow them over. Little bit like Bush on 9/11 giving his New World Order speech saying, we have a real shot here at not the law of the jungle, but law. Well, you're leaving out a pretty big point there, Bush, because it is the law of the jungle that gets you there, if that's even ever the plan. Sheer muscle, sheer control of assets, sheer control of banking, militaries, and all these kinds of things. And this is the world that we now have to come to grips with. If you want to have goodness and decency, there are people and organizations like this in our world that don't give a fig for the rules.
All right, well, that's going to do it for hour one. We're not even a third of the way through the points yet that Rothschild supposedly laid out to his conspirators or co-conspirators. This is a really interesting text, to say the least. A lot of what was said here did come to pass. And again, I do got to wonder just what William Guy Carr had come across probably during his intelligence work to be able to lay things out like this in the 1950s.
There is a text that claims that he was offered membership in something, and they use the words hook, line, and sinker, and that he said no. That's the claim. It's a hell of a thing, and I would put forward that if you see the Middle East destabilized to the point of war, then what you're looking at here is the actual coming together of not only what Pike said, but what Carr said. And again, I'll say it as we close this episode, I do not accept that William Guy Carr lifted this information from Pike. And there are good reasons not to accept that. The least of is that he served as an officer in World War I and then was in intelligence in World War II. And so many of the information sources that we get are coming from intelligence in the military-industrial complex. By the way, when he wrote this book, the military-industrial complex had only been labeled that for what, Jason? Less than a handful of years, right?
When he wrote this, the military-industrial complex speech hadn't even been given yet.
Oh, I thought it was in the early 50s. When was it?
1961.
Oh, was that late? Okay. Well, there you have it. Didn't even have its name yet. And we're referring to the Eisenhower speech, where he supposedly warns us all that there's a military-industrial complex, and he's very concerned that it will get out of hand. Welcome to 2025. Anyhow, Hour 1 is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crrow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode, and members get access to everything. For $8 a month, they get access to all the forums, threads, comments. They can create their top levels on all those things. They can stream the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon, covering all my older lunar telescope work, all the lunar waves, and the first discovery of the so-called second sun, which, in my view, will become a big deal as we get further into this era that we're currently in. It is my point of view that the second sun will be undeniable at some point because everyone will be able to see it. Also, all the solar imagery that I have created is available to folks on the website, and members of the website get exclusive access to my current solar work with a 130 millimeter solar scope. Only three of those have been sold in North America, I am told. With that, we're going to take a short break, come back for hour two, and I'd like to wish everybody everywhere a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers. We'll be right back.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.